Yeah, I've never really quite given a talk like this because it's a mishmash of all kinds of things. But anyhow, we'll see how it goes. And you guys probably mostly want to hear about the LHC schedule, so therefore I put it at the end of the talk to make sure I'd at least have some time for this. And you know, if you want to interrupt me, you probably should yell rather than raising your hand.
Mike,
be distracted.
What's the blue stuff in the parking lot?
Looks like muon chambers.
Okay.
So.
Well, it looks like glass. I was wondering if there's a water spout in the hall.
So it occurred to me that I've been working on what you might call super collider physics for 25 years, as have some other people like Ed Berger, Howie Baer, Vernon Barger. You may notice that if your name doesn't begin with a B, you can't. You're excluded. So, given that much time, I can't tell you how exciting it is to be able to tell you that the final piece of Atlas was lowered down last Friday. This is looking up through the shaft, and this is the what's called the small muon wheel. There's two of those, and this was the last one, and it's down in place now. It's just another picture of it in which you see it up here, and down here you see a muon wheel, and you see the end cap toroids looking small, but there's a picture I took of me a long time ago of me standing sort of here, not in this picture, but anyhow, and these are the barrel toroid magnets and the rest of the detector over there. So we're not done though. It's mostly connecting. This means things like cables, fibers, cryogenics. And in fact, in the case of the pixel detector, which is the innermost part and only about this high but very, very long, the cables are done. It's just these two things. And naturally, so this is when they start taking so the celebratory photographs. This is two of the large muon wheels as opposed to the small ones you saw. And one of the things I've noticed is that we're getting an enormous amount of press coverage. And since I was going to talk about this in part because I handle a lot of that for Atlas. And so I watch it more maybe than most people do. So an interesting little quote from The Guardian that particle physics is the unbelievable in pursuit of the unimaginable. To pinpoint the smallest fragments in the universe, you have to build the biggest machine in the world. To recreate the first millions of a second of creation, you have to focus energy on an awesome scale. So Jennifer, I don't see how we can compete with language like that.
It's a rave.
And well, there's also some great language in this article, which was the three full pages in the New York Times science section. Unfortunately, they chose the wrong detector to feature. But and then the next two pages, just to show you, looked like that. I actually got very involved with them here. When they first sent it to me, I counted and there were 21 significant errors in the graphic that they had made. And so I was kind of embarrassed to have to tell them they had, even the title had confused accelerators and detectors. Since this is a theory workshop, you recognize that guy. I bet you he knew him. So then Ed Berger just pointed out to me that the latest issue, see, March, of National Geographic has this famous photograph. And unfortunately, they picked up, which too many things do, the God particle, something I really don't like. You know, it's God particle, God particle, God particle. And that's Atlas, like in November of 05 or something, somewhere way back. So I just highlighted here a couple of interesting things from their story. There's a setting that calls to mind the subterranean lair of one of those James Bond villains. And again, some interesting language. If all goes right, matter will be transformed by the violent collisions into wads of energy, wads, which will in turn condense back into various intriguing types of particles, some of them never seen before. That's the essence of experimental particle physics. You smash stuff together and see what other stuff comes out. True enough. I believe that Howie talked about that yesterday. So they too featured the wrong detector, but it's a beautiful picture. So I just thought I had to show you this. This actually was taken by a very famous photographer, Peter Ginter. his name is down there, in fact, who did some spectacular stuff, but Alice didn't really think much of him, and they didn't let him photograph much. So actually, I just wanted to show you that it's not just the newspaper. It's all over the web, everywhere you go. So this was sent to me this morning, in fact. So a website gave people this photograph and said, Photoshop it. So this is stuff I just put on into the talk this morning. So what there were, so then they show about 25 different versions of this made by people and sent to them. And I picked out about 10 of the what I thought were the interesting ones. Looney Tunes. Star Trek, with the Earth in the background, I guess. Now you gotta look a little. Here's the detector, here's those magnets. Beautiful. Amazing. What people can do. This one I don't sure I like because I don't like the idea of fire, but there's some other interesting things. There's a car here. This is an upside down, I think, car. Yeah. And who knows what else is hiding in there. Weird. Notice the outside is left alone, but the inside is changed. This was really interesting. There's the magnets, the torrid magnets, but the rest of it's gone. The Wizard of Oz. We're off to see the wizard. Mind the gap. Really amazing what people can do. And then this one, reaching out and touching. And this is the last one I chose, which did some strange things with it. Moving on. So it's not just newspapers and the web that have picked up on this. It's appeared in on television and in Discovery Channel. It was actually made in Canada. I want to show you your thing, and now we're going to find out if I actually, let's see, I mute off. Hope the volume will come out all right. Let's see. I have to remember how I'm supposed to make it full screen.
To find out why we exist.
So why is it buried so deep underground?
I made some cuts in this. This is not the whole thing. It was a longer piece. I just picked out parts.
Under the earth as well. In fact, it takes place 100 meters below the French-Swiss border. But it's not a volcano. It's not a lahar. It's very impressive because down there there's a machine called the LHC, designed by CERN, European Organization for Nuclear Research. That machine is being engineered to answer some of the deepest questions we can ask. Very close to 100 meters below the ground of France.
They've used some of the graphics that we made in Atlas. This one in particular, for example.
The LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, is a tunnel at CERN spanning a whopping 27 kilometers. To give you an idea of how big it is, just one of these four detectors along the tunnel is as tall as the Parliament buildings in Ottawa and as wide as 1.5 blue whales. Scientists have been waiting for 15 years for the final pieces of this to come together. It may help them uncover the biggest question of the ages. Why do we exist?
Well, I mean, it's a fundamental question, the basic question that mankind has been asking since the beginning. We're here 80 meters underground. That's the Atlas experiment.
If they see particles leak out of the accelerator, they believe it could be proof of other dimensions far beyond our meager universe. That's right, universe.
Gravity is weaker than the other forces. It's actually much weaker. Of course, we don't see that because the Earth is extremely big and all that stuff. But gravity is much weaker. One idea is that it's weaker because it actually leaks out into extra dimensions.
This leads to another obstacle. To prove this notion, they need to accumulate plenty of data. But how exactly does one store information for 40 million collisions per second?
Over several years, you'll be able to fill up enough CDs that will reach the top of the CN Tower.
There are three levels of systems to record the information. The smallest amount will be recorded on something called the grid, part of which is being built.
And I cut that.
Forget textbooks. This could be the existential relief we've all craved through the ages. We may finally have an idea where we come from and why we exist.
Little did you know what you were doing. Okay, we go back to the talk. So, you know, communicating what we're doing is a little complicated. This is an Atlas expert explaining the evidence to a layperson. So he's talking about the detector and the physics, and then this is sort of an interpreter here, and this is what the layperson gets out of it. So I wanted just to mention something. Again, I warned you this is a mishmash of things. So since I was talking about the news media, one of the things we were doing is trying to start a program within the U.S. to bring students to CERN as journalists, to report back to students and hopefully a lot of others and hopefully get news coverage and many things. And this will be happening very soon, a month from now. So what we've done, we had a competition and 60 high schools applied, and we chose four, and then two others somehow snuck in. So we have six teams of high school students. Each team has three students and a teacher, and they're going to CERN to report on the LHC startup. And so they're going to learn about LHC, Atlas, and CMS by interviewing physicists and engineers and actually getting to see the experiments. And then, as I said, they're going to act as news reporters back to not just their communities, but all across the U.S. This is a DOE-funded program I mentioned, and each one of these groups is going to prepare a video. So you know those pictures I just showed you, but imagine, you know, what high school students with some teacher supervision will do trying to make videos about what's happening there. And since it's overlapping the open days, the last day they're there, there are going to be 30,000 people of the public there, and so they're actually going to film the public showing up to see this. And part of what we do, we always like to talk about things of this sort. What are the interesting numbers that you record the debris from 60 million proton collisions per second with amazing precision that you've got to use the grid to be able to do all this kind of work. Atlas is, and by the way, CMS is heavier, is about 100 747 jets, which sounds pretty impressive until you remember that they make them light so they can fly. But anyhow, it's 100 747 jets. It's about half the size of the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. There's many miles, or if you're European, kilometers of superconducting wire and even more of ordinary cables, and just phenomenal amounts of data recorded, as it was in that movie, and there are 100 million electronic channels. I also like to, you know, we try to describe who is Atlas. You know, it's an interesting sociological phenomenon, and it's sort of the opposite of Bechtel, a very top-down organization that builds tunnels and bridges and many things. And so we, of course, are huge numbers of people from about everywhere, and one of the things Atlas has been doing is taking pictures of ourselves that try to make us look a little more interesting than we usually do. And we also like to point out that we're all over the place. Another thing that it's important for people to realize is that, you know, you think about events, things, and they sort of show up on a piece of paper or in a talk, but you've got to see the scale of it inside of Atlas, what an event looks like. And mind you, this is missing most of the muon system. So this is the inner part of Atlas only, and this is sort of sets the scale of what you're looking at.
Where's the tunnel? What's the dimension of the tunnel on that foot?
Tunnels, I don't know, 10 feet high?
I mean, so, the beam pipe?
Or the beam pipe. Well, you can't see the beam pipe in there.
Yeah, so the beam pipe is
very small. So actually, for reasons I'm going to talk about in a moment, we used to call them mini black holes, but we now call them microscopic black holes. And it's just another picture. These events are black hole events are really fun to use, and it's the one we show most often because it's the most interesting. And the reason, of course, is that you get all of these primary partons, if you wish, that come out. And so you get enormous amounts of energy in coming out and in many directions. And one of the interesting things, when I first looked at this event, I noticed there was something wrong here. If you look at the muon here, it's curving in here, which means it's a low-energy muon. We just keep it in there because we wanted a muon in the event. So you throw that out. This isn't very energetic. There's nothing going this way. And I said, what's going on? So we went back and found the original data for it, and it turns out there's two, like 600 GeV neutrinos heading off, primary partons. So they're not decays, they're the primary, well, except the decay of the black hole. Sorry?
What generator is
this? I didn't generate this, so I don't, it was generated in Britain, and I don't know which generator they used. So the problem with talking about black holes is that, so what I did 2 days ago, or one day ago, was I just went to Google News, and I typed in CERN black hole. And I think this was the third thing that came up. You know, some of the world's top scientists, including Nobel Prize winners, are preparing to create black hole material in a laboratory in Europe this spring. And the new material created by this collision is unknown to humanity. Its dynamics are unpredictable. The methods and requirements for containment are unknown. And if an accident occurs and an uncontrollable black hole is created, scientists do not know how they will destabilize it.
Remember, those bloggers may listen to this talk, too.
It's all over the blogs. I once did a search for over blogs, and I found one on ESPN, which was talking about basketball for the first part, and then it switched into black holes at CERN destroying the world. So this is not remotely unique. And anyhow, they say, let's see, there was one line in here. So CERN has talked for a long time about how to respond to this and the current thing. I mean, Steve Giddings could tell you about another project on to try to address public concern. Whoops, I hit the wrong button. So now we have to come back down here. Where were we? Let's get back into that. So this is sort of CERN's response at the moment. Cosmic rays are continuously bombarding Earth's atmosphere with far more energy than protons will have at the LHC. So cosmic rays would produce everything LHC can produce. They've done so throughout the 4.5 billions of years of Earth's existence, and Earth is still here. And the LHC just lets you see these processes in the lab. So this isn't really the whole story, and maybe later Steve can give you some other additional thoughts about that, but for the moment I want to move on. We also, besides showing many black hole events, do try to explain how it is you actually, to the public, would see, a Higgs boson, which is the most covered subject, the God particle, as the other news stories called it. And so this is just one example. Higgs going to ZZ. I speak in CERN so much, I start calling them Zeds now. So this is just a picture. This one is actually has, of course, a jet going this way, the Higgs going the other way, and then decaying into particles. And so it's just a graphic to try to help explain how we actually see it. This is just a different way of looking at it. Same event, actually. No, it's not the same event, sorry. And also, again, in context with the woman over here. But again, showing only the inner part of the detector. So, again, part of this mishmash talk, since I happen to be chair of a new users organization called the US LHC Users Organization, and we, along with the Fermilab and Slack people, are heading to Washington next week. And it's an interesting time because, as you all know, this year's budget for particle physics in the last literally few hours got chopped from a fairly nice increase to horrific cuts. And so We're going to be going to Capitol Hill. We also have a meeting with OMB and OSTP. That's the Office of, for those who don't know, the Office of Management and Budget and the Office of Science and Technology Policy, I guess. And we also are meeting with the people in DOE and NSF. So, although here it's not so much, these are really lobbying. This is more just talking about what we've learned and what the strategies are.
Michael, are you trying to affect change in the current fiscal year or next year?
What does you refer to? Me or people in general? There's been a lot of argument about this. I think there are some efforts going on in the background, including at APS. These efforts are going to, if they happen, will happen at a high level only and not involve us. Most sources I talk to, and this is my own view, feel this is fantasy.
Do you affect this year?
That you will not affect FY08 at all. And so if you look at the one pager that we're taking there, there is no mention of asking for something. And in particular, there's a request here, which I'm going to blow up and show you in the next slide. But what we try to do is, if you haven't seen this before, the chairman and CEO of Intel wrote that the U.S. stands at a pivotal point in our history. Competition is heating up around the world. The only way we can hope to compete is with brains and ideas that set us above the competition, and that only comes from investments in education and R&D. So we put that on there. We talk about the sort of innovation that comes out of our work. We talk about preparing the workforce, who we are, things of the sort. And there's actually a backside which just talks about the big issues of our field and how we're, if you look at this map, how we're all over the place. So this is what in that first page, what our request was. And what we asked for, the problem is that what they're talking about at the moment is a continuing resolution that will go on for at least half a year. And if we get caught, and the problem is, if we get a continuing resolution means you get funded exactly as you are now. Well, we're stuck in the worst year in our history at FYA Omnibus Bill, and that's the last thing we want. In fact, here, if you want to see, high energy physics at DOE went from here to here. And so what we're asking is this is actually the president's budget on the bottom line, which the crucial point for us is that it be based on this budget, not on this budget. But if there's a continuing resolution, we're screwed. Even if it only went on for half a year, by that time, you know, Fermilab will be back into furloughs and layoffs because they have to assume the worst. They can't, you have to base your whole year on the continuing resolution. So what we asked for is, and we spent a long time trying to figure out how to word this, but the early enactment of the two things. The continuing resolution, there are 13 appropriations bills, and the continuing resolution only applies to those that have not been passed. So if we can somehow convince them, the NSF is hiding in here and DOE is hiding in there. The problem is, of course, both those bills have other stuff in them besides us. But that's where we're at. So just for fun, decided to we started talking about this with Lawrence Krauss, and he'd already been doing some things like this, and so I just thought I'd show you quickly a few pictures. This is a drawing which is often described as being a few hundred years old, but there are things on the web claiming that it's a new drawing. Don't know. We colorized it. That wasn't in the original. Salvador Dali actually literally called this to research of the fourth dimension. And certainly the Dora Maar series is trying to talk about looking at things from multiple perspectives. And then in literature, there's Narnia and other such things. So Atlas itself has a really strong outreach effort. We have large numbers of people coming to our outreach meetings, and we have the management of Atlas has been, I would say, enthusiastic beyond anything any experiment has ever had to do things of this sort. So this is our public webpage, which has a nice simple thing of atlas.ch, which is Switzerland. And we have various things that these are actually sort of changing scenes, various scenes inside of the experiment. You should go there and find out. Then we have our latest news stories. This is not actually an up-to-date picture, the news story. is, of course, about the last piece coming down. And all kinds of features and things. And we also have a news page, which we modeled. We went around and looked at everything from the New York Times to Le Monde and BBC and things, and sort of tried to design a web page that picked up on a lot of their features. And so this is what our news page looks like. And we also have a page that's just for the news media of who are trying to collect information. And I don't know if you guys have seen any of the, we have all kinds of things. We have animated things, we have videos, we have some longer features like 20 minutes. I think I'll show you, just to give you a couple examples. This one is nice because it shows you the something about what it's like to work in the Atlas detector. Up near the top here. G, of course, can only get into the muon system through this way. Well, actually. All right, well, I'm going to cut that. Goes on for a while longer. That was about two-thirds of it. Where's the one I want? So we mounted one of those giant toroid magnets. We mounted a camera onto it and then of course this whole process took 5 hours to lower it, so what you're seeing is not 5 hours. Probably should show this in a smaller size. The resolution isn't so great. So you're on the toroid magnet, heading down. Fun to watch the people running around over there who work very fast. Cut off the ending. I want you to look at this area. I'm going to tell you what happened next. We cut off the ending for political reasons. The ending had a French worker get onto this platform here, see the camera there. They don't like cameras showing them working. He looks at it and stares at it and says, "Stephanie, Stephanie." And nothing happens, of course. The camera, he can see the little red light, so he knows it's on. So then another guy comes up and they sit around and talk about this for a while, and the other guy goes away. And then he comes back, and he comes up there on this platform with giant cutters. And you see him walking, turning around behind the camera, and suddenly it goes black. It's always some issues of that sort. I think that's enough for now, but there are lots of other things I could show you. And most of these are on YouTube also, YouTube, the Atlas Experiment. There are 18 up there at the moment, and the most highly viewed one has 11,000 viewings. And almost all of them, they get have ratings that that the viewers give to them, and almost all of them have 4.5 out of 5 stars. And this includes, of course, our famous what we called episodes, which if anybody's interested at the end, I could actually show one of them. But I won't now. And our website, which I mentioned just a little earlier, has also been getting very much, and you see the sort of escalating interest in what's going on by all those hits. Okay, so about halfway through my talk, that's good. We'll talk about the LHC schedule, and I was going to actually put on here a big thing that said, you know, censored, you know, blocked the view and all that. Some parts of what I'm going to show you is very public. This one is. There's a time schedule I'll show you later that isn't public, but I found on the web, and therefore I feel it confirms what I already knew about the schedule, although even not as much. So this is relatively up to date, and there are four stages they talk about, and it mentions that this run that was scheduled for 2007 was canceled. I'll come back to this whole subject of that in a few slides. There's also talk about a sector test. You know, there's 8 sectors, and sectors, as you go around the ring, you know, Atlas is at point 1, and then CMS, I think, is at point 5 or something, I don't know. But anyway, there are all these points. So each sector goes from one point to another, and so they're numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, so on. And so there's a possibility of running beam just through one of those sectors. And so if you look at what stage A involves, it assumes, by the way, things, you know, they're not stupid. They know that you can't actually ever run the beam all the time. So they're assuming limited ability to inject. And I'm going to show you some slides later that actually talk more about the configurations of these things. So I'm not going to emphasize that here. Make the point that they're aiming towards a fairly high luminosity, although I don't think that's going to happen. But anyhow, they believe this will happen fairly quickly, particularly in stage A here.
Sorry, beginning in May.
Yeah. For the moment. I have the microphone on, so yes, beginning in May.
That's straight away with 7-on-7.
No, we'll come to that too. So there are interesting issues that come in. So you vary how many bunches you have. You can vary the beta, the tune. You can so then you work your way up in bunch intensity and in luminosity. And so, you know, theoretically, if all went well, notice that things don't necessarily go linearly because there's different combinations they want to use going from here to here, then they switch here again. And they can get up quite high, but if they actually got there in this configuration, you end up with 4 events per crossing, which is not what you want, especially not at the beginning. So stage A, so this is just stage A, and how many days? Well, they show you all these different things they might do. Notice 451 of them, a little more detailed. Then you try to get both of them in there. Doesn't say anything about colliding them here. And then you might do some ramping. And you know, that whole process might take you something like 30 days. And by some imagination, you end up with a pilot physics run before too long. Stage B, so now you've change the time between the, what did it say in the previous one? didn't say. Right? Anyhow, you're talking about, this is the time between bunches. And so this is all done with this. And again, you work your way up to some fairly nice luminosities, but you begin again to start encroaching on the multiple crossings, multiple events per crossing. Page 3, now you cut it down, and there's a lot of debate about these times, so this is not something that's obvious what they're going to do in the end, but now notice a lot more bunches in, and you can actually start getting to design luminosity, although beyond design luminosity, but you don't want to go there. So, I mean, this is sort of gives you an idea of where they might be at that point.
What is the last column?
I don't know. Not an accelerator physicist. It looks says percent intensity total, whatever that means. And then on to this. You're still sitting at this time. This is the time that I'm not sure they will actually do. And the reason is you get a lot of multiple events. So here you get to this. This is 3 years down the road or something. But and there we do know that we're going to get a lot of interactions, and that's just life.
25 nanoseconds is the time between bunches.
Yeah, I think so.
And roughly, why does that increase the number of collisions per crossing?
It's the
bunch intensity.
Actually, this decreases it. 25 nanoseconds decreases it. 75 increases it, because then you have to put more stuff into each bunch instead in order to get to the same luminosity. So I hope I didn't say otherwise.
So what exactly is the situation there? I mean, it's not decided yet, or?
I mean, they're going to feel their way along through a lot of this process. They have various plans. They have alternative plans. There are people who are, you know, there are a lot of arguments going on inside the LHC people about how to do this. This is a little bit they talk to the experiments, but, you know, particularly because they have to worry about these things and other aspects, actually, of recording data. I mean, if you get more frequently you have an event, the more frequently you have to record something, and if things are not yet working fast and you have delays, you don't really want to see 25 nanoseconds. So the question about are they going to do 450 GeV collisions? They're certainly going to inject at 450 and have two beams running around. Are they going to collide or not? And the answer is a limited period only, and this is very limited. Two or three shifts, like in other words, a weekend on it. That's all they're talking about. And as he says, this is the common view of the experiments. Such a run is not required by the experiments. Basically, they're not even, well, they don't care so much now. They really wouldn't have been happy last December. But there's some arguments from their purposes for why it might be useful to do this for a few shifts. And they can learn some things. And then an interesting little remark I found, that the experiments would not require the magnets to be on for this short run. I'm not sure if there's an argument why they shouldn't be on, but anyhow. So Steve asked, what energy are they going to actually run at? And so this is actually text that they said. But I've looked at a lot more of what they've written in some of their talks and things, and so I will comment on that. The general approach is that they will only drop from 7 TeV if there is a problem with a magnet. And as it says, it could be a weak dipole or quad causing problems as they push up to maximum current. There are limited gains for machine protection by dropping to 6 TeV, so machine protection isn't necessarily the issue. And as an example, there's only a factor 2 reduction in the quench level by reducing the energy. The catch is, it's not obvious that they can get the 7 TeV. I don't know if my later slides show that, so let me come back to this if they don't. So this is the official schedule. And let's see, the date, I don't think it's changed remarkably since then. In fact, if you look on public locations, on the LHC website, you can't find a schedule with a different date. So the public thing hasn't changed. And you will note, as people have said earlier, things sort of get shut down, some starting in April, and come back to that problem for the experiments. And then you have a month of what they call machine checkout. And so at that point, actually, at this point here, the beam pot gets closed, which causes significant problems for the experiments from that point on, because they lose ability to work on some parts of it when that happens. So from this point on, the beam pipe is closed. Then they have a month or so of playing around, and then there's this, what they say is beam commissioning to 7TV. And so this is the claimed schedule, so you would see collisions in July. Now there's some interesting things if you look more closely on here. Machine checkout probably means they're going to start circulating some beam and trying to do things, and if you'll notice, there are things happening inside of that machine checkout time. So how is it that they're able to work on the sectors while they're supposedly checking out the machine? So, I mean, people have pointed this out for a long time, saying, you know, how does this make? So this is the Atlas critical path. And again, they've done these little tricks of moving things around and when they're going to get done because of problems I just mentioned. And the reason the pixels are running late, by the way, if you haven't heard that story, was the lowest tech thing probably in the detector. The cryogenics, when you warm them up, if you just warm them up and didn't do anything about it, you'd have condensation inside the pipes, and they don't want that. So they put heaters. There are heaters that are put on, and one engineer designed the heaters and did a bad job and then left the experiment, and they had all kinds of problems with the heaters. So they had to redesign the heaters, remanufacture them, put them in a different location, and they lost a couple of months in that process. And so that's the reason pixels are late. The other thing about, in general, about both LHC and Atlas and CMS is that these things all had time contingencies and ways of playing games of this sort. Those are just basically gone now. We're too close to the end. There's no time contingency left. Anything goes wrong, there's no solution left. You can't rearrange work anymore in any significant way. You can't. You have no time contingency built into your schedule anymore. And this was, by the way, February 15th, so it was also fairly up to date. So, again, what are the early conditions likely to be like? You probably will be running at one of these and not at 7TV. Certain management, of course, doesn't mention that. Fewer protons per bunch. Sorry, for those who are listening to the recording. Many fewer bunches, and actually, you know, there's a crossing angle, but in the beginning, they may be running actually head-on, which I don't, for us, doesn't make any difference. So not in the short term. So sometimes, especially for those who aren't experts, I like to sort of remind of what all these definitions are, even this is sort of good to remind oneself of periodically. So the basic idea, officially at least, was 2 times 10 to the 33. I think most of us would be more than happy with 1 times 10 to the 33. And of course, after something like 3 years, it's supposed to move up, largely for Higgs search, if you haven't found it. So what I did was assume just 1 times 10 to the 33. Remember what the definition of a barn is, and then you can just, and then you also have to assume that 1 year, you know, which is really is this many seconds, but in reality, you need to assume you're only running part of the time. So if you did this, you would end up, say, with 10 inverse femtobarns. But this is not the beginning, of course. So it's just sort of interesting to see the numbers that you get for assuming what happens in a year, a month, and a week. And so what Atlas has been generally assuming is that the luminosity is 10 to the 31. In the beginning, 1% of what it should be. And if you remember from the earlier slides, they actually are talking about getting above that. But anyhow, Atlas is being more cautious and just saying 10 to the 31. So if you imagine a 3-month run, you might end up with 30 inverse picobarns. But, you know, who knows? And it's interesting to look at what a year is. You want to look at this first. So this is what a typical year might look like. They only actually have operation during this period. And then if you actually look at what that corresponds to, there's other funny things happening inside of there too. And so the physics part is only this part. And that might be 20 weeks at best out of the year of actual running. So that's what a typical year of real running would be. And the next, this slide and the next one I found in a talk I gave 3 years ago, 2005. So this next slide is interesting in that context of that I didn't change it. I'm giving it to you the way it was 3 years ago.
What's the purpose for the winter shutdown?
Cost of electricity.
Electricity in Geneva. It's the other way. Geneva has no electricity for heating.
Is this really critical here? Because I guess the biggest part of the electricity use is for cooling the magnets. We don't really want to warm up the magnets over the winter. So do you really say?
Nice question. I don't know. That's true. The cryogenics eats up a large fraction. And this is another thing that the news media tend to be confused about. You know, they think about a beam going around, and you talk about all the power usage, which is equal to that of the whole city of Geneva. And they imagine, of course, that power is in the beam. But it isn't. It's in things like cryogenics. And so Dieter's question is a good one. I don't know the answer to. But it may be that they eventually do have to shut down and warm things up because they need to get into the beam. So if they have to open up the beam pipe to do things, you do it. I mean, they can deal with the problems they run into. It's a 2-month delay, but you know, you're allowing 2.5 months of shutdown. So there's time to fix the problems, the finger problem, and anything else that comes up by warming up the magnets. So that's probably the answer, is they do warm them up. So again, this is, emphasize, an old slide. But I noticed that if all I had to do was to change the years by 1 year, and actually it's remarkably similar. And so this is sort of gives you an idea over the next few years what the luminosity might be like. And keep in mind, though, that they're playing these other games with the timing and things like that, which you see a little bit in here. And that may be changed. So you could go from 75 to 25 and turn around and go back to 75 again. They've talked about things like that. So let's see. So we look at this thing here. You know, nicely starts in April, just like the current schedule officially does. And you have some beam commissioning in around here, which is probably more realistic. And then you start doing physics sometime, maybe a little bit earlier. And so you start out, of course, with extremely low luminosity, because the main thing is not to damage the experiments. So you just want to see if you get things up to whatever it is, 6 or 7 TeV, and not destroy pixel detector or even worse. So it starts out very low, but then they fairly quickly pick up the luminosity. You notice there's not much, you know, just a month there and you're at this luminosity that Atlas is already assuming. And in fact, maybe this graph is why they're assuming that. But then when you get into, and again, this is a 3-year-old schedule, so you've got to take that into account. You can start getting up into more interesting luminosities, and then notice somewhere around here, you get to 2 × 10^33, but then they switch into this other mode, and actually luminosity goes down a bit. And it's back up again, and then, you know, who knows? Hopefully this doesn't really happen. We don't need that. And you know, years later, you get to this other goal.
So, looking at this, it occurs to me that if sort of the realistic target right now is October, if that gets shifted just a little bit, you're into the mandatory shutdown phase.
Yep.
So that really means the following year.
But we're starting in July.
Just curious.
You don't have the lead run at all.
Well, in this version, they were late, and so the pilot run was like 3 weeks in this 3-year-old version. So they were assuming that they would only do a pilot run. That's not the current plan, but could become the current plan. And then, which case, You don't want to have a worry about seeing data until 2010.
There's no heavy ion running in this.
Heavy ion guys are going to get shoved back quite a bit, probably. It's not clear when they'll first run, but certainly maybe it'll have a one-month run about a year after the first real run of protons.
You didn't say anything about the other two detectors, OMCB and ELISA.
Well, ELISA is the heavy ion run, so they can't get anything of a substance out of the proton running. They're just not designed in a way that could do that. LACB is doing, I think, coming along well. At least they too could be a month late. But I know less about them. But they're not far off schedule, you know, at the level of a month. So what integrated luminosity might we have in 2008, ignoring the Steve Giddings types who imply that we might have a three-week run? So I was slightly more optimistic and assumed that we might end up with 30 inverse picobarns. And hopefully, since I did this in a hurry yesterday, I did this right. So assuming that, and so depending on which process, what this is a bunch of different things. So this is a Higgs at 500 GeV, a Higgs at 150 GeV. Oh yeah, put this in bright yellow so you wouldn't fail to read it. There are jets of 100 GeV, and of course, the only line you really need to look at is this one. This is the LHC. And so you look at that, and so if you're looking at this graph, you would see, assuming that you got that luminosity, you would see 10 to the 8th events, roughly speaking. And if you were looking at a 500 GeV Higgs, you might see 100 events before this stuff, which is very important. So.
Luminosity of 10 to the 3?
No. Where did you see that?
On the right axis.
Oh, just don't worry about that. I don't know. I didn't look at that. I was just looking at this, trying to understand how many events we'd see.
What are the terms that are going down?
Oh, because they're doing funny things. This is ET jet greater than square root of S divided by 20.
I see.
I don't know. You know, given that if you're only looking at one line here, you don't care. That one makes no sense as something to look at. And then trying to actually put in some of the decay rates. And so I mostly just focus on this one. So the pilot run, you'll just be flooded with W's and Z's. A lot of tops even, here if you want to tag them just with muons. Still a lot of tops compared to Fermilab. A lot of QCD jets, energetic ones. Oh, and I think actually, if I understand that, which I didn't write, it means that they pre-scaled. So they're only taking 10%. And minimum of the bias and gluino in some model, somewhere in this range. So this is at the very low luminosity. I mean, it's a great thing about LHC. Energy is so much more important than luminosity. So just for some balance, my friend Greg Landsberg has given a lot of talks about how we're all way too optimistic about how we're going to find physics early on. So for a little balance, I've stuck in these three slides from his talk. So. He compares three other machines. I think this is a little too far in the past, and this has got electrons and protons. So let's just look at this. So fair amount of energy increase. They did their first physics run in the summer of 87, and it was years later before they got to a high luminosity run. And discoveries, they found the top. The paper was in 1995. First publication was a year later, a year after turning on. It was the particle PT spectra. And of course, they found quark substructure in 1996, again, years after. These guys found leptocorks and, well, the next, we'll see. So this is, now notice this is run two at Fermilab, not run one. Started in March, so that you might argue that, that Tevatron didn't have the benefit of a real, this type of proton collider to work on, to benefit from. And so it might have been a bit slow, but run two, they had the benefit of run one. So they started in March. It wasn't until September that they managed to get the physics run going. But they did have some stuff they announced already in the summer of 02. And they, but it wasn't until any publication at all, until 03 or 04, despite the start. However, despite what the speaker yesterday said, the first realistic jet energy scale, they had only a year later. This is run two. You were probably referring to run one. You said 2 years. This is 1 year. But again, run one could have been that. Probably was. So strangely enough, they didn't even get a cross-section, a top cross-section, until 2004, and the mass until 2005. The first JETS plus missing ET paper, he wasn't sure. This is Greg Landsberg, remember. It wasn't until years later. I'm not sure what it's about. So maybe Howie's right. Maybe he's being optimistic. Who knows? And then Greg, just for fun, put up the discovery of supersymmetry, which those of you who are too young don't know about, but it occurred 24 years ago. And with the observation of five events in which the missing transverse energy greater than 40 GeV is associated with a narrow hadronic jet. And we cannot find an explanation for such events in terms of backgrounds or within the expectations of the standard model. And it was announced all over, especially Italian news media, that he discovered supersymmetry. So, what time is it? I've overrun my time, as I knew I would. So we put out a lot of internal news things for the public, and of various sorts, and actually, this was probably one of our more challenging topics, was to talk about cabling, and there's actually a really nice movie about cabling, which is quite something, but it uses copyrighted music, and you can't use it until it gets replaced. We've also been doing profiles of different people within the experiment. And again, this was the news coverage. It's a nice picture, and I think I... So if you look in, you can find more things about it. But anyhow, this is... They had there's a water leak problem there that they wanted to fix. And so these two guys went down. They originally solved the problem by channeling it off and using the water for some other purpose, not trying to solve it. But they had to train one of the Atlas people to do this, and then... And in fact, I think that the professionals went down first, and then he went down with another one professional to work on this problem. Another picture of that. And we got a lot of interesting pictures. I'm just going to go fast here at the end. Some really great pictures about how Atlas works. Oh, I didn't bring it with me. We have a scroll pen. I was planning to bring here, but I can show it to anybody who's interested, which is an ordinary pen in most respects, but right here there's a little piece which if you pull out, on one side it shows this, on the other side it shows that. We're very good at PR. And we're working very hard on to get students involved in analyzing data. And we're doing this with a program that's a lot like a computer game. And so they can... look at an event, rotate it around, they can click on a particle or a jet, and it gets added to a table. They then combine those and find out what the invariant mass is. You can turn, this is an older version of it, but anyhow, you can turn various things on and off so you wouldn't see everything. And the most interesting part, the most crucial part, is the PT cut. If you look at this with no PT cut, of course, you're just flooded with particles. And so if you really want to get down to what's important, you need to have this little slider here, which you push over to do that. And if you want to see a standard view on the end or the side, you can click on those and you immediately changes in there. We also have views that show the events inside the detector, and you can fly through the detector as you can in many computer games and see things from any perspective you want.
Do you have something that rates the user's performance and, you know, it's
well,
top 50 list?
Well, this is actually aimed for use in a classroom. It's not simple enough that it could be used without explanation. And when they're done, they're supposed to put up a poster about it, a web poster. And those indeed can be criticized by others, and others can say they agree. So. And I don't know if there's anything more. No. Yeah. That's it.
Questions? You know, Michael, on your slide having to do with material you're taking to Washington, there was the comment from Craig Back.
Yeah.
Not to be confused with Barnett.
Right.
But there were two parts to his op-ed in that San Francisco Chronicle article, I think it was, right? Wasn't that where his op-ed was?
I've forgotten where it was.
But in any case, the first part is what you're quoting from. But I'm wondering how much...
He gets very nasty about Congress in some parts of that note.
But
we didn't want to quote that part.
Never mind his criticism, but the second part, or the last third or something, of his op-ed had to do with his immigration arbitrage, right? In which he's pushing again the notion that
sure.
The U.S. is too restrictive about people coming...
Sure, Silicon Valley wants to bring in more people.
Right. And so I think he hurt the cause, or at least the cause that I'm thinking about. Right? It was great to have his support in the first third or two thirds, but then he hurt it at the end, right? Mixing it up with his other arguments. So I just wonder, when you're dealing with Congress, which part of his op-ed they remember?
Did they read it?
Yeah, they read it. They pay attention to it.
Well, then the part they remember was the part that was very critical of their performance.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm leery about quoting him to people in Congress. That's
too late.
I know it's
too late. It's been printed.
You were talking about the 25 with the 75 nanosecond warning. What I got from your presentation is that the 75 nanosecond should be a relatively short period. But is there, though you are a little bit vague, I mean, it depends on what exactly is going to happen.
Depends on how well it works. Yeah. I mean, they're clearly happier running at 75 than they are at 25 from the accelerator guys.
So how much of a chance would you say is there that actually the 75 nanosecond point will be an extended period, let's say more than a year or something?
Depends on what the luminosity is when they get there, because if the luminosity is not that high, then the problem of running at 75 isn't so bad, and they may just stay there longer. So, but if you know, what you don't want in early running is to have two or three events per crossing. Because you want to be able to understand what you're doing first.
So that's the general attitude in both CMS and Atlas.
Well, I can't speak for other thoughts of people.
Because, I mean, if you're only interested in the highest PT events, it doesn't really matter how much soft stuff you have.
They're not only interested in the highest PT, they've got people interested in everything, you know. Yeah. 2,000 people in each experiment, you've got a lot of people with a lot of different interests. I mean, you know, as you heard last week from, if no, you weren't here last week, but my colleague Tom LeConte's is working on standard model physics, mainly as a way of sorting out when real physics shows up. And well, it's really clear his real interest isn't in the standard model. He's not trying to test the standard model.
Are there benchmarks necessary for detector commissioning?
Oh, yeah.
Nothing.
No, I didn't. There's a lot of things going on. I mean, the closest I came was the mention of the magnet tests, which is certainly, they've tested all magnets, they've never tested them together.
Yeah.
And there are implications of that. They are already doing cosmic rays in large parts of the detector. They're missing the pixel detector because it's not connected. And so that will certainly go on. And they're doing a lot of that. They're doing a lot of testing, what's called the full dress rehearsal, which is a way of testing the whole way you read data and send it out. So they, of course, had to make up data. But and to try to, you know, so you make get as much data as you can and then try to push it through the system, which is to start at tier zero, which is CERN, and then goes off to the what are called tier ones, which includes, for example, Brookhaven. And from at each of these levels, the data gets changed into a slightly lighter format. And then it goes on to tier twos, which includes SLAC. SLAC's a LHC institution now. So there's those type of issues. The triggering system is, you know, was got the least funding and the least attention in the early stages and is struggling along. And so there's a lot of testing of that has to be done. There have been problems with some of the electronics that they actually built them and you tried to use them. They didn't work well. And so that's why tile cal and liquid cal, liquid argon cal are running late. So there's a lot, you know, phenomenal amount of activity going on at the moment, and but you know, it's the detector is built. We didn't drop anything on the way down. It was, you know, it's interesting. I guess the biggest single pieces were the eight barrel toroid magnets, and they'd done endless designing, but they were smart enough to decide they would put together a wooden one and take that down as a test. And you know, they had all these drawings and everything else, but what they didn't notice was that there was a light fixture sitting out like this from the wall or from the scaffolding, and it was in the way. So they learned something from taking down this wooden model, and then they got the others down without a problem. But the way they came down, I mean, if you imagine you had this much space, they came down like this, and then could barely clear and get straightened out. And of course, you lower them with one crane. You have to pick up the caverns crane and then put them down with that, because otherwise it ends up over there and not over here. So there are, you know, there are just endless numbers of benchmarks along the way. And it's an amazing operation. I mean, they had to lower thousands of pieces down the shafts. And the guy who's head of technical coordination for Atlas, I mean, he just did an amazing job. Also, the whole rearranging of the schedule because things get back. And so in the early, you know, you can't do it now, but that all the way along, they've been doing things which kept them more or less on schedule by really ingenious rearranging of the order you do things.
Do you know what the status of CMS is? Is it all down in the
cabinet? CMS has got everything down, yeah. And CMS is a little bit different. It was mostly built
on servers.
No. Built. Yeah. Let's see.
Built in large pieces on the surface.
Well, they can slide in and out of place, so it's a different thing. We fill the cavern and there's no other place at all. So if you want to see it, actually, of course, you need to get there by April. Around April sometime, they're going to stop access. And they're working hard in the Atlas control room already. There's all kinds of testing going on in there. They've set up this, you know, the usual sets of tables with monitors, and they're actually monitoring things and looking at the cosmic ray events and watching cryogenics and all the things that you do there. And so there, each subsystem has a sort of round tables there.
So are there any unpleasant surprises in the testing? Cosmic rays?
Not at all.
Like,
looks good.
One piece is exactly one meter off.
Well, that was the early thing in the when they were running Monte Carlos, when they noticed that events would start out of the detector going this way. So here's the center of the detector, and then they would finish going out of the detector over there. Somebody was 180 degrees off in their designing of the Monte Carlo. But they have not had such problems recently, since they'd already been testing a lot of these systems. So.
No black holes yet, dear. Not even from cosmic rays.
So, Steve, so I'm going to ask a question of an audience member, to which I know what he's going to say. So what's wrong with the argument that CERN is currently giving about mini black holes?
Well, that's a little bit of a long story.
Give us the... you want to do it another time?
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
So we go for landing around 12:15.